Culture eats strategy for lunch, and informed cultures drive decisions and inspire action. At the Data Culture Podcast, we talk with execs, visionaries, and leaders so that you may do drive idea to outcome in your own data culture journey. Welcome to the Data Culture Podcast. My name is Sid Atkinson, data culture innovator and consulting leader with over 21 years in data.
And I'm Lee Harper, AI human with over a decade doing various AI bits and pieces. And today we're joined by another person who's been in AI for a long time, Ron Green. Ron is a serial founder with many successful exits in his past. He's currently the CTO and co-founder of Confidor.ai and also the host of the Hidden Layers podcast. And so welcome, Ron.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So one of the things I'm going to talk about today is how you build the right team in the AI space, both how you build your AI team or teams, as well as what other people you need to kind of bring in to make that capability a success across the entire enterprise rather than just within one little research lab. Tell us about, maybe we'll start with how you, in your own company, Kung Fu, identify the right people to bring on and hire and structure.
Yeah, we think about this, as you might imagine, just constantly because it's really challenging. I think as AI becomes more integrated into the technical world and companies start embracing AI and integrating it into their product capabilities, pretty much everybody out there is going to start hiring AI, machine learning, data scientists. And so from inception 7 years ago, we really thought hard on what type of capabilities and mindset we really wanted to identify in the people that we would bring on to build these, you know, really complex systems. And we've sort of locked in on a few things that we think are really, really important. One is this appetite for continuous learning. You know, AI is advancing at a breakneck pace. If you are not somebody who is just really interested in continuous learning, you're probably not going to be very successful in the long run. Because if you stop learning now, you'll be outdated in what, 12 months, 18 months, 2 years at the most?
That was true in the past. I remember I kind of briefly stopped learning from about 2015 for a couple of years because I was moving to America. It's a pretty big change. And yeah, come 2017, I was like, and it's even worse now than it was back then.
So it is. Yeah, it really, really is. And so that's one of the things we'll identify in the beginning is our, you know, somebody looking for people that are just really, really hungry to learn sort of indefinitely. We also think that a focus on an experimental orientation is really important because unlike traditional software, of course, AI is much, much more experimental and research driven. Most of the techniques we're using today are supervised learning techniques. And so you're building models that learn from the data. And so you're really kind of very much limited and beholden to the quality of the data. And so getting in there and analyzing and exploring and understanding the data is really, really, really important. It's how we kind of front load all of our projects. And so having that curious experimental mindset, I think is really another big part of it. And then I would also add a couple more that I think are really important. One is interdisciplinary capabilities because AI is being integrated across domains increasingly. Like we're seeing multimodal models, right? You have audio and image and text, and you're applying these techniques to different domains. You really have to be open-minded and able to collaborate and work in new environments pretty rapidly. And you know, there are a few more, but I would, the one that I think is probably last from sort of top priority is an ethical mindset of understanding that because we're building these really powerful systems that are data driven, that you have to take the time and you have to be concerned about the bias that may be latent within these data sets. And that's something that, you know, I say this all the time as an old AI practitioner. This isn't something we used to worry about. You know, we couldn't get the systems to work, you know, in meaningful ways back in the day. And so, you know, things, you know, we didn't worry about security. We weren't really worried about bias. We were just trying to figure out the fundamentals. Well, those days are over. And it's like the internet. In the beginning, they were just trying, you know, to get computers to talk to each other. And then later, once that worked, they kind of went back and layered on security. Well, that is not an option when it comes to data, because if you build these AI systems, and the data has bias in it, it's going to soak that up and propagate it. So it's a really important component that we look for when we're interviewing.
One of the things that you said, the point about the domains, the middle learn new domains, when I'm looking at people like on LinkedIn or other places saying, hey, here's what I think you need. A lot of what you've said, I think, is, you know, I think a lot of people in the field would broadly agree with. The one that I see most disagreement in, at least within my network, is the domain expertise. I see some people who are like, no, you need domain expertise. If you don't know this domain deeply, you can't work in AI in it. And I see other people, and I agree with you. It is possible to learn new domains if you kind of talk to people and ask good questions and are open to soaking that up. Do you see that same disagreement within your kind of network in this area on the importance of specific domain expertise in like insurance or FinServ or, you know, pick specific thing here?
It's just kind of funny. I would actually agree with both perspectives in a way. here's why, is you cannot discount the domain knowledge. So if you're an AI expert, and let's stick with that example, Lee, you know, and you go to work in insurance and you go in and you think that you are just smart enough that you don't understand, that you don't need to understand the nuances of that domain, it will not go well. So you have to either be a domain expert or collaborate with domain experts to build successful production AI systems. But that's where I agree with sort of the other perspective, which is you don't have to be a domain expert yourself. You can acquire those skills over time, or you can collaborate with domain experts. But that domain knowledge is not optional. But there are just multiple paths, I think, to getting successful AI production models into production.
So we've all seen the sheer quantity of AI content that's available to learn, right? You can, you know, pick any platform right now, you know, that you choose to learn on. Tons of AI courses. All the big providers and have just also had their own AI courses. And you said upskilling constantly is really, really important. How do you go about sorting out for your teams or teams that you advise in your consulting work, which are the courses that are worth doing? And how do you help people kind of make the jump from the tons of basics courses to the more, probably fewer number of more advanced level courses?
Mm-hmm.
How do you guide people in that journey?
We took kind of a radical approach on this question a few years ago. So we've been building AI production systems for about 7 years. That's all we do at Kung Fu AI. And we were struggling candidly about 2.5 years ago to keep up with the pace of AI advancement. Pretty much all the systems we're building are right on the bleeding edge. But, you know, we're working hard. We're working, you know, long hours frequently. And it was essentially an implicit requirement that engineers were going to read white papers in the evening or do coursework on the weekends and things like that. And it was just burning us out. So we did something kind of radical, and we instituted what we call lab day on Fridays. So Fridays are completely set aside. They're non-billable. We take, you know, 25% of our revenue generation capacity, or 20%, and just set it aside entirely. And we use that time to read white papers together, to have guest lecturers come in, to do prototyping and work with new frameworks. And for us, it's really a collaborative sort of team sport to stay up to date. If you're getting started, you know, and you're trying to find that initial foundational course path, that's a little bit different than what we're typically dealing with. We're dealing mostly with experts that are trying to upskill in different areas or stay on the bleeding edge. But the reason I mention this is that I think it really demonstrates how fast things are moving. I mean, to Sid's point, you know, it's just incredible how fast things are moving. And so we had to carve out an entire day for that. As far as specific types of materials, we're kind of living in a golden age of education. There are unbelievable amounts of high quality content being put out there on YouTube and different websites. I'm a pretty big fan of a lot of the stuff that's done by Andrew Ng and the Coursera work. I think that they take a really strong foundational approach to teaching things. They don't jump into the code. They'll start with the math and the concepts. So I tend to point people in that direction if they're trying to get started or they're just learning new concepts for the first time.
And of course, DeepLearn.ai just put out a data engineering course fronted by, you know, Joe Reese and others, right, to try and kind of fill that kind of, to your point earlier, the front-loaded gap, right, that, you know, this stuff needs data to go anywhere. So if data engineering is not good, well, the AI is going to be pretty poor as well.
Yeah, the whole idea of garbage in, garbage out has never been more true than it is for, you know, these supervised AI learning systems.
So, Ron, you mentioned something back at the beginning when you're talking about the capabilities. So how have y'all, when capabilities, mindset, and the people, so appetite, experimental, interdisciplinary, ethical mindset, just going back to that real quick, how have you ensconced that into the culture at Kung Fu? Everything from how you recruit, language you use, how have you made that a part of, just the way the company, the OS of the company?
There are a bunch of things. So we go all the way to the beginning. So when we're creating job descriptions, mm-hmm. we really do believe that diverse teams are more capable, more powerful. And so mm-hmm. we do things like review our job postings for, you know, gender bias verbiage. So you'll see a lot of stuff like, you know, ninja warrior or rock star.
Yeah.
You know, AI engineer. And we really know that puts some people off. And so we do things like that from the inception. We take the ethics stuff crazy seriously because it is so important. So, for example, we have weekly ethics meetings. Every single project that we are potentially going to go mm-hmm. And work on with a client goes up for review and goes through the ethics board review, and it has to be approved. We literally walked away from our very first potential client for ethics reasons. They wanted to use AI for something that would definitely not have made the world a better place. And so we just said no. And I would say over the last 7 years, we've probably passed on, you know, maybe close to half a dozen engagements that we didn't think lived up to our ethical standards. And then another component of this is how you actually guide your clients through the engagement. Mm-hmm. So we talk about ethics and bias, but if you don't put that into practice in the actual execution of a project, it doesn't really matter. So we always do bias data analysis and mitigation as a part of our engagements. And so my go-to example that I always try to, you know, use to really make this land for people is we've built things like housing valuation prediction systems. And we built this on a historical data set that went back decades rather. Yes. And we found systemic biases
yeah.
that were racially and ethnically motivated in that data set. And we had to do certain things to actually suppress that and remove it from the data set. And these are things that our clients weren't even thinking about. Like when we did the analysis and presented the results, it blew their mind. It was very obvious in hindsight. But as AI experts, you know, all of us are responsible for guiding our clients on this and making them aware that if you leave that bias in the data, the model will learn it and propagate it. And then you are not in a position to be able to say, oh, I've got this super intelligent AI that's making, colorblind decisions. No, it's actually learning to just propagate those biases that were present in the data set. And so all of that together, I think, is how you go about building and sustaining ethical AI systems within production.
Make is that although, you know, when you deploy system, it's automatic, humans have chosen the data, humans have generated the data, humans have made decisions about how that's used in the AI system. So although, yes, the algorithm made me do it, the algorithm is driven by a ton of human decisions.
That's right.
That have happened.
And, you know, there is no possibility for unbiased data or unbiased models. They're going to have some type of bias. The question is, what is that bias going to be? And you just have to put that on the table and be aware.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Some people don't think about where they focus a lot on the bias that might be in the data and forgetting sometimes that there's actually bias even in what data is collected, right? Like what is on the form, you know,
exactly.
what is on the page as I'm creating that data, there's a lot that we choose to leave out, just like our brains filter out a lot, you know, and when we're perceiving the world, and we have been trained over, I don't know, hundreds, millions of years on what to pay attention to. We're doing the same thing with how we collect the data.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And just one more really quick point.
This is
on the sort of AI hiring profile.
Yeah.
Another thing that I would really, really recommend people focus on, and I see this is maybe one of the biggest misses that a lot of companies make is not focusing on sort of software experience or best practices, meaning modern AI, very data-centric, very math-heavy, right? And if you are just focused on the analysis and the modeling and getting your loss curves down and all that type of stuff, it is going to be really challenging to get that model into production because the devil's in the details when it comes to production, right? It's all the million corner cases that you have to handle. And so we focus really hard, and I would recommend, you know, anybody listening to this, building an AI team to the same. Hire AI engineers that care as much about good software engineering practices like reliability, scalability, you know, good design. All those types of things really, really matter when you're building production AI systems. And it's something that we screen for also in the hiring process really, really heavily. You don't have to be a software expert. We can get you there, but you have to care and want to become one if you're going to be successful.
The number of data science teams that when I ask them, so what's your unit test framework? And they don't even say, we don't know. They look at me funny. Like, what do you mean a unit test framework?
Exactly. Like
you're writing software.
You're writing software. I mean, AI is not magic. This is software, right? It's complicated. But if you are not writing tests and thinking about it, you know, like traditional software development life cycles should be, you're really making a mistake. It's not magic.
We had a VP of AI from Cox Automotive, Jenny Blomberg, on the podcast about 6 months ago. And her expression for this, which we love and we use ourselves now, is don't build toy boxes.
Yes. Yes.
You know, innovation labs are great. That's not what the value is, right?
That's
you need
right.
to getting stuff out of the innovation lab and into, you know, real life. And, you know, what AI adoption costs is like $3 of adoption per $1 of dev time.
Yeah. Yes. You know, a couple more points there, which are amazing. I was actually talking to a very, very large multinational services company. They will go unnamed here. Protect their identity, but they said that their data science team over the last couple of years had built 200 prototypes and not one of them had made it into production successfully. And it's for those reasons that you just mentioned, Lee. It's like, you know, getting a prototype, you know, working to 60-70% is much less than half the battle. I would argue that's like 20% of the effort. You know what I mean? So people have to be aware. Software best practices really do still matter.
Well, I think in my mind, I really like also the interdisciplinary aspect that you mentioned, because we take the same approach, but our interdisciplinary, because we also do data engineering, data management, and little bit different focus than what y'all have, our interdisciplinary is also extends to the business side of it too. And so and I'm sure you see this a lot as well, is that I can go, even if I put the best engineers on the problem, step one is making sure I've got the right list of problems, and then knowing, you know, having a kind of business mindset to say, it's like, you know, I could spend a lot of time and potentially get traction and solve this thing, but now if I keep doing that, the ROI is gone. Because at some point, like, this maybe is not a problem that's ready to be solved today.
That's right. That's right. We see a lot of companies making that same mistake. Mm-hmm. And it's really unfortunate, because I believe deeply, because most companies are just now taking their first steps to integrating AI meaningfully into their product lines, that there is just an unbelievable amount of low-hanging fruit. You don't have to go, you know, do a moonshot on your first initiative. Most companies out there will benefit from doing something relatively simple, and you will have a really, really high ROI. In fact, at Kung Fu AI, we literally tell our clients, if you're not looking at a legitimate X ROI on your AI initiative, you should probably move along, because there are going to be many more better opportunities.
One of the most famous models that's higher FedEx has for minimizing left turns.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
It's super unsexy, right? How do we minimize left turns, right? But, you know, on busy highways here in the United States, that's a huge efficiency saving for them. That's worth, like, you know, the very least hundreds of millions, if not $1 billion+ just on that thing alone.
Right.
Right? It's not a sexy problem. It's a hugely important problem, you know, for making, you know, for increasing delivery efficiency.
Yeah. I mean, you're not only talking about saving time and saving fuel costs, but you're talking about increased customer satisfaction. You know, it checks all the boxes.
Yeah. The other interesting thing is how often, Ron, as you're working with some of these folks, your customers, that we focus on one or two metrics, but then forget the other benefits. So, for example, a few years back, Lee and I were working with a government agency, and we were looking at dollars, fraud loss on dollars, but then, you know, we pulled up the agency mission and says, like, but there's a protect part in this. And so if we actually stop this particular type of fraud, then are you measuring the human impact? Because there's equipment and vehicles and other things involved. So unsafe equipment, unsafe vehicles, you know, so not only is there a financial component to what the state wasn't collecting, there's also a human safety component. We're like, oh my gosh, we're not even measuring that. We have no idea.
We saw something similar with a project that went to production this year where, you know, very briefly, it's essentially sort of loan approval in the factoring space. And once the model is in production and it's now trading like hundreds of millions per month, but not only did they move from a 40-hour work week with like 24, 48-hour turnaround to 24/7, 9-second turnaround, but fraud also dropped too, right? Mm. And so, you know, you can get these multifaceted benefits from AI models now in a way that were much, much more difficult to do just, you know, as recently as, you know, 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. So that's the reason we think when companies are looking at ROI, you should really focus on big ROI more so than big moonshots.
Yep. And then I think the other part too is because we talk to our customers a lot about this is the capability, right? Like, so look at, and the thing we say on the team all the time is above the line, below the line. So above the line, the projects that you do, that's where you get the ROI and the business feels the ROI. The below the lines are people, process, and tech. And so the more robust and more capable it is, the more you can do above the line things. In other words, long way to say, I agree with what you're saying. Because you want to get those above the line thing, because it's that gaining that gaining that capability. So they'll go do the first thing. You learn how to do it. You learn how to get something all the way through production, test it. And I'd also kind of make an argument: how can you guarantee ethics and safety if you don't have testing? So you get that testing done, and then now you get the first win, and then that kind of builds some momentum for the next couple.
We're seeing the exact same thing, which is once a company gets an AI model into production successfully, the whole organization's attitude changes. Like, they feel so much more confident. And they also, it's really strange. It's like, there's this misconception sometimes that these models are either magical or superhuman, or once they're deployed, they're uncontrollable and they'll be making all the decisions. A great example is the loan prediction model I just mentioned. Mm-hmm. You know, the model's making predictions. That doesn't mean we have to act on them, right? So we put together a complete policy shell around that. The model will take in some input. It will make a prediction with a confidence estimate on that. And then that can be fed through a bunch of traditional software, you know, rules and predicates. Mm-hmm. You know, humans will ultimately make the decision. The AI is just providing input. And that's, you know, that's something I think that is a little confusing in the beginning. And so once organizations get a successful deployment and they understand the power and the limitations, they are typically much, much more capable of identifying opportunities and getting those solutions into production.
Yeah, it's kind of like everybody needs their Bannister moment, exactly. Like their Roger Bannister. Yeah, for
and you break that 4 minute mile.
You break the 4 minute mile. Everybody's off to the races after
exactly.
that. So
how one of the things that I see a lot of people struggling with, especially people on the business side or even software engineers, right? People who aren't data scientists or data science adjacent, is these systems. We said they're like software, and they are in many respects, but the outputs are probabilistic in nature, right? With GPT or any LLM, for example, you feed the same prompt in, even with a low temperature, a seed set, 10 times. You get 10 slightly different responses, right? It might also be the same thing, but it won't be the exact same set of words that come out each time. You know, we make a prediction about loans of some kind. There can be many predictions made, and they're probably outputting a probability or a future regression value with some interval around that. You know, and you get, say someone gets a probability of 80% that comes out of the model, right? How do you work with non-statistician trained stakeholders to become comfortable with the idea that you can have software the outputs probabilistic or changing outputs for the same input?
I love that question. Okay, so that this is really huge because, you know, as much as I'll say things like, look, AI is just software, right? It's deterministic. There's no randomness. Now, it's complex and it can be hard to interpret and the outputs can be probabilistic, but it's all just software in the end. But like you said, Lee, that probabilistic nature is a big change, right? And so there's a couple of things that we will typically do to help people understand that. One is that interpretability is something that you have to factor in really, really early on to the development cycle to determine its impact on both the modeling approaches that you may want to take or how the user interface might even manifest itself. So, for example, if you're building a recommendation engine for products, you may not care. You may not, you know, need to interpret why it recommended this sweater or that sweater. But if you're building, like, let's say, a loan approval system, there may be regulatory reasons why you need to be able to explain and interpret your output. And that could drive the entire data analysis process and the architectures that you put together, including the user interface. And then when it comes to things like, let's say, clinical, you know, medical diagnoses, you know, none of us want to live in a world where the doctor comes to us and says, hey, you need to have an operation, and you say, why? And she says, I don't know, but the AI model told me so, right? Like, you definitely want to understand that. And so getting on the table as early as possible, the facets of the probabilistic nature, the fact that you can tune these thresholds, right? You can have, to dig a little bit more into the medical one, let's say you're building a model to predict or diagnose cancer. Well, you're going to have some amount of false positives and false negatives. There's almost no world where we'll live in where, you know, we'll have certitude there.
Well, if you do, your model's often wrong, right? If your model has perfect alignment, you've got something of data leakage going on, and you've made a mistake somewhere in your process.
That's exactly right. That's 100% right. And so, you know, we could easily build a model that was right like 99% of the time and just say you don't have cancer, right? Because most of the time, people don't have cancer. But you really want to tune that threshold. In this example, you probably want to tune it to have more false positives than false negatives, right? Because it's better to incorrectly predict that somebody has cancer and then have them do further screening and have that be falsified than accidentally tell somebody with cancer that they don't have cancer. And so tuning that threshold and doing that balance based upon the specific domain and the specific use case is another really huge part of this. And that's something that most people, most product development teams have never really had to deal with. So you add in the lack of interpretability sometimes, the fact that you're dealing with probabilistic outputs that may come with confidence intervals, and the need to tune thresholds. You know, it can be a shocking new world for people embracing those concepts for the first time in a product environment.
Yeah, we had Lee and I, and also not to be a named entity, but working with a larger company to integrate their software with our customers, and they were doing churn prediction, I think it was, Lee. And so they would give back answers, but no scoring. And we're like, well, wait a minute, we might want the scoring and the probability here and where this kind of rated on a scale so that we can run it through. And they're like, wait, what? What are you talking about?
Why would you want that?
So wait, yeah, you're saying you have these models built into your software, into this endpoint. So where's the rest of it so that we can use that? And it's like, okay, this is useless to us.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're going to treat, you know, 51% confidence the same as 100% confidence in that instance.
Yeah, yeah.
So things are evolving in this field real fast. We talked about some kind of emerging area. Well, I say emerging, I mean, I was doing the start of the cancer field, like, no, when I started my career, it's come on a long, long way. What would you say, Ron, are some of the kind of key emerging trends that people should know about? What are the things that people, of all the swamp of things that people could look at, what are your kind of top few things that people should be interested in and should even look at upskilling on over the next 12 months or so?
I think there are several things. One is there's been certainly a big shift in focus, especially by the frontier labs, to spend more time and money on compute inference. So as there's been sort of increased parity between, let's say, Anthropic and OpenAI and Meta, et cetera, in their large model capabilities, there's been a shift towards inference time compute. And that's the idea of giving the model, instead of just sort of a fixed compute budget, you take in some prompt input and it runs its inference calculations. Instead of having that be finite and fixed, giving it more time. And one very popular approach there is something called chain of thought, of course. And the idea behind chain of thought is that it's almost like the model talks to itself, right? The model will take its output, and of course, this is an autoregressive model, meaning that the model is taking its own output as its own input back in, and it's almost like the model's talking to itself if you look at the output, and it will assess, and it can actually figure out if maybe it's on the wrong path, if it's made a mistake. Sometimes you'll even see the models verify two or three times. Like a really simple classic example is if you ask the model, how many letter R's are in the word strawberry? To date, most language models really struggle with that type of question. Well, with this chain of thought reasoning, you can literally see it going and breaking down. It will talk to itself. I'm breaking down the word one letter by letter, and then it gets number three, and it goes, let me go double check that to make sure I didn't make a mistake, and it runs the compute again. What I think is interesting about this is kind of two things. One, OpenAI has done some pretty extensive experimentation with this, and they're showing that the gains on the inference side compute expansion are matching the same scale of training. So the amount of money put in the data set or the parameters on training and that sort of log loss scale we're seeing there, they're seeing a different but similar sort of loss curve on the improvements with inference time compute. And that's really, really huge. And then the second part is it sort of begs the question, how much would we spend on inference time compute if we could do something like solve the Riemann hypothesis, right? Would we let the model think for a day, a week, a month, if it could solve this incredibly important math question? And I think we're going to see more and more of that coming up. And that's one of the big innovations and trends so far. Another one that I'm really excited about is small models, right? And this is kind of at the complete opposite end of the spectrum. We're seeing, through a combination of reduced parameter sizes, higher quality data sets, like sort of almost like Microsoft calls it, textbooks are all you need, as a joke, a riff on the attention is all you need paper. Synthetic data sets that are generated from upstream models. So meaning you can have generation two act as the teacher and classifier to train an even better generation three model, and then you can quantize it and make it smaller. And there's been a sea change there. Anybody listening to this that wants to check it out, there's a project called OLLaMA. You can run these amazingly powerful single billion parameter models on your laptop and get really, really impressive results. So synthetic data, higher quality data, smaller model sizes, and a focus on inference, I think that those are some of the most exciting things that have happened from a technical architectural perspective in 2024.
And for the small models, do you want to just briefly explain why kind of maybe people that aren't so technical should care about that? And kind of why that's a thing for your CEOs, your product owners, kind of why should they get excited about smaller language models?
There are really a bunch of reasons. So one is just cost. The bigger a model is, the more parameters it has, essentially, right? And so that means you need bigger GPUs or many more GPUs. And that's not only for training, but that's also for inference. So when you obviously training a model costs more money than running a model, but it still costs increasingly more the more parameters there are. Speed's also another big component. If you need very, very fast inference times, the more parameters you have, the more compute you have to use, and the slower your output would be. There's also, I think personally, a really, really important one, which is sort of democratization of AI. And I kind of can't believe I'm going to say this, but Meta, of all companies is really at the forefront here with their Llama models. And the fact that they have spent hundreds of millions of dollars on developing these really state-of-the-art models and then open source them, and not just open sourced, you know, the weights and the source code, but they also are now, as of this summer, allowing for commercial utilization with some caveats. That's really huge because it means that companies, and there are very few that would have access to, let's say, the amount of compute needed to train these models, can still benefit from them. And we don't have the lock-in of, like, you know, an OpenAI becoming a monopoly. And to put this in perspective, Ella Kuhn, the chief AI scientist at Meta, a couple weeks ago mentioned that they are training Llama 4 right now on 100,000 H100 GPUs. So that's about $3 billion worth of GPUs.
Yes.
And so that's the reason I think that is so hugely important.
And most companies wouldn't have to train these models themselves. So it means they can actually, you know, pull these models down from Hugging Face or wherever else and be able to use them themselves. Sorry, Sid.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
I know the crazy stat I looked at the other day, it was at 99, NVIDIA owns 99% of the GPU compute market. I knew that other people are in it, and you know that AMD, you know, here in town has stuff, but I hadn't quite collected in my head how staggering the disparity is. They have all of it.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the driving force behind their $3 trillion market cap, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, one thing that this is a bit of a tangent, but a thing that I don't think gets enough attention, that is a challenge we're going to see. You know, everybody's been struggling sort of with GPU access. It does seem to be stabilizing, and that's less of a concern, especially for sort of American-based companies. But power access is increasingly a challenge. And, you know, there's some crazy things going on there. So, for example, Microsoft plans on buying all of the power output of Three Mile Island. Exactly. And OpenAI said they're going to build, I think it's in Miami, they're going to build like a data center. No, I'm sorry. I messed it up. OpenAI is going to build a data center. I don't know where, but they expect the power generation just for this one AI data center to equal the consumption of the city of Miami.
Yeah.
Well, and there's been rumors that Google are looking to buy nuclear power stations.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Power is suddenly the new, you know, limiting factor to AI.
Yeah. One more thing as well that, like, I remember some years ago, maybe 5 years ago, there was a big thing about, you know, FPGAs being used for some applications in the field, programmable gate arrays. And we're seeing people like Google creating like TPU chips, right? They're actually a bit more, GPUs are still general purpose chips, although they're obviously being built for AI. These TPU chips that Google are building are a bit more specialized to, you know, specifically, they're actually laid out to a point how AI systems actually do the linear algebra that kind of determines what the outputs are. Do you see kind of that evolving, like, you know, more specialized AI chips that aren't GPUs? Or do you kind of see GPUs kind of ruling the roost for the foreseeable future?
That's a great question. I do think we're going to see more specialized hardware, especially as we converge on a couple of different architectures. So if you go back, 5-6 years ago, if you were working in natural language processing, you could barely talk to somebody in computer vision, right? All the modeling techniques were different. All of the data pre-processing techniques were different. The architectures were radically different. And then this convergence on the transformer modeling architecture that was innovated in 2017 has changed all that. And so now all of a sudden, everybody is kind of tokenizing their inputs. It doesn't matter whether it's audio or video or text. You're using fairly similar AI pipelines in these architectures. And now you've got things like multimodal modeling being possible, where you can combine a sort of arbitrary input modalities and outputs within the same architecture. And so that's the reason I think this focus, at least in the short term right now, on that attention mechanism within the transformer architecture, that's going to lend itself to a lot of optimization at the hardware level if you know exactly what that sort of compute pipeline is going to look like. Now, on the flip side, I do think that there is a problem, a foundational problem with transformers, in that it has quadratic compute complexity. So as you double your input size, you quadruple the amount of compute you need to perform. And so I think approaches like, there's a new architecture out there called Mamba that I'm really, really interested in. And it uses sort of state-space modeling and other techniques to dramatically reduce the amount of compute. And to your point, Lee, it leverages a bunch of sort of hardware-specific knowledge to make it much, much faster than it might look actually sort of on paper. And so I think there's going to be a wave of investments in hardware innovation over the next few years.
And now I think we'll finish with perhaps the impossible question. Transformers are only good, they're only going to go so far, right? They've got us a hell of a long way in a short space of time, but artificial geointelligence, as Yanmark and us say ad nauseum, is not going to come through a transformer architecture, right? It still is to some extent the stochastic parrot, right? You know, it does great things, but it's limited by its training corpus. Now it can't truly think in any meaningful sense as we define it. There's bound to be another innovation, like, you know, when the LSTM came out, like when AlexNet came out, like when, you know, the Transformer came out. When do you think that innovation is going to come out that's going to kind of make us go, oh, Transformers, that's so old hat?
Yeah, man, that's a really, really difficult question.
I warned you.
Oh, I am very hesitant to make predictions about the AGI timeline, only because I truly, truly believe that we are seeing emergent behavior in these models. And what I mean by that is, you know, language models, literally by definition, just take in some input and try to predict the next word or token, right? And I would argue that the ability of these large language models, once they get to a certain scale, to have these emergent, amazing abilities is, I think, the most important scientific discovery of our lifetimes. And nobody saw it coming because, essentially, by definition, emergent behavior is unpredictable. You can't really foresee it or predict it, right? And so I don't know how far we're going to be able to push this current paradigm. My guess is it will tap out. I don't think we're going to get AGI-based systems simply using, you know, autoregressive language modeling approaches. But I also wouldn't have thought we'd be here. You know, if you asked me 5 years ago, I'd have said, this is crazy. This is like, you know, climbing a ladder thinking you're going to reach the moon. It's just not going to happen. So I will say this. I think we're closer to AGI than people outside the field realize. But I think we're also still missing key pieces that we don't know about yet that when they fall in place, we will see large jumps in behavior and more emergent behavior, but those pieces are still missing.
Like the classic thing, we tend to overestimate the short term, but underestimate the long term of these kind of things.
Exactly.
Well, Ron, thank you very much. The last 20 minutes has been a wonderful geek out for me, so thank you very much for that. Hopefully our listeners enjoyed it as well, as much as I did. So yeah, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Ron.
My pleasure. This was an absolute blast.